This absolutely filthy music evokes the spirit of another time. And remarkably, it's 60 years this September since the premiere of Goldfinger, the third James Bond film, from which, of course, that music comes. When I watched the film again recently in preparation for this lecture, I was actually struck by how tame some of it seems now, 60 years on, which I guess is pretty reasonable. But when we look at the footage of the premiere in Leicester Square, we can see that the Bond frenzy was quite considerable back then in the 1960s, and the public is vying with the police and with each other to try and catch a glimpse of the stars of the film, albeit minus one Sean Connery, who was off making another film somewhere else. But someone who was there was the young Shirley Bassey, who, of course, memorably recorded the title song, or the title song over the opening titles of the film. And here she is with Barbara Streisand, who was the subject of the first talk in my series about divas. Here they are both after the Oscars ceremony in 2013.
The Gresham College lecture that you're listening to right now is giving you knowledge and insight from one of the world's leading academic experts. Making it takes a lot of time, but because we want to encourage a love of learning, we think it's well worth it. We never make you pay for lectures, although donations are needed. All we ask in return is this: send a link to this lecture to someone you think would benefit, and if you haven't already, click the follow or subscribe button from wherever you're listening right now. Now, let's get back to the lecture.
In that talk, I talked about the idea of the word diva and how it has both positive and negative connotations. On the one hand, it literally means a goddess, but it also comes with positive words like glamorous, successful, outstanding, things that we might want to be or want to be called, and then also things we might not want to be called, like petulant and demanding. And these are the reasons why Barbara Streisand very strongly dissociates with the idea of being a diva. She said, "I think I'm not a diva." Shirley Bassey, on the other hand, finds it an empowering idea. And so what I'm interested in this lecture is how she found that point where she became a diva as opposed to an extremely talented popular artist. So let's stick for a moment with Goldfinger and look at clips of two live performances of the song. The first one comes from 1974. From a concert that she gave at the Royal Albert Hall. And I think in this one, she's still at the extremely talented and wonderful popular singer stage. And the second one comes, would you believe, from the National Lottery results show in 1997 when she was 60 years old. But in this performance, I think you can see that she has become a diva in the intervening years. So let's take a look at these two.
It's a kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of his heart of gold. His heart is cold from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of his heart.
So we can see, you know, it's a nightmare talking about this topic because she is so impressive in so many of these clips that it's hard to say anything equally effective in between. But anyway, there's huge power and impact in that performance, which I think is typical of Batty once she has become a diva. And the first clip is also wonderful. I don't want to seem like I'm saying anything critical of her. I just think that something hasn't yet quite landed and arrived in her career. When I started thinking about this song, I noticed for the first time how peculiar it is and thought what a nightmare it must have been to be asked to write the words for a song called Goldfinger. And by coincidence, the papers of Leslie Bricus, who was one of the two lyricists along with Anthony Newley, were given to the Library of Congress just about 3 or 4 months ago. So I managed to get scans of some of them. And here we can see what's marked, at least, as the first draft of the lyric of Goldfinger in Leslie Bricus's hand. And one of the things that surprised me is that even though there are some unfamiliar things, we see these strange lines like, here he comes, what a man, and some ideas that they discarded, like king of gold, man of gold, we do get some insight into the struggle to write this song, because the lines are quite short, and it's not really about anything very meaningful. And there is a bit of working in here as well. They change the word world into the word web. But basically, the song is there. And the reason for this, when I dug a bit further, is that John Barry, who wrote the music for many of the James Bond films, including this one, wrote the music first. So John Barry toured with Shirley Bassey in December 1963, and during that period played for her the music to the song Goldfinger 6 months before any lyricists had been hired, and therefore the lyricists, once they had been hired, inherited the structure of the song. So I guess that's why on one level it was easy to write some words. But then on the other hand, the details required quite a lot of digging, because they had to indicate something about this weird name and also something about the plot of the film, about this man who kills people by spraying them with gold paint. I mean, it doesn't really inspire lyrical thoughts, I guess. So day two, which is the 12th of May, 1964, we find them struggling again with more ideas that we might not have seen before. On the top right-hand corner, you can see a bunch of words that rhyme with gold, funnily enough. Thousandfold, sold, foretold, what are you going to do? Top left-hand corner, generic ideas for badness. And then at the very bottom, this line that they struggled with. So they struggled to find out, what is this song going to be about? And of course, what it turned out to be about in the end was a warning to women not to mess with this man Goldfinger. And so this warning that comes in at the end of the bridge section, so this is the middle section of the song, is, as each golden girl knows when he's kissed her, it's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. So you can see the workings of the song are all here on the page, and you realize it's quite amazing that Batty managed to spend 40 or more years singing this song over and over and over and making it convincing. And this is part of why we realize what a great diva she is. But on the other hand, I think there are things about this that make it a great showcase for her. So these words, which are a bit ridiculous, do allow her to sing about death and danger and punishment for sex. So there's a kind of sense of suffering in the lyric that she can play upon to give it some kind of emotion, I guess. The rhythms are very turbulent. The vocal line is very cleverly written, so that it builds up to the most exciting part of her voice, where she can belt that final note that we heard in that National Lottery performance. There's a mixture of sustained lines and kind of choppy, thrown away lines, because the lines of the song are not very long. And the words seem both serious and not, and personal and not. I mean, she's singing about death, but she's kind of twinkly while doing it. And there's something about this grey area of interpretation that seems ideal for her. She can stand there and deliver this frankly bizarre lyric, but kind of achieve power through it. So I'm interested in pursuing how she got there. If we look at her early life, as is well known, she was born and brought up in Tiger Bay in Cardiff, which is the Dockland district. It was an unusually multiracial area for the time. It was home to sailors from over 50 countries, including her father, who was from Nigeria. Her mother was white and from Yorkshire. And so for the first few years of her life, actually, they lived in quite deprived circumstances, but also in a kind of harmony, because it was a very diverse community. Her father was deported when she was a child, and so her mother moved the family to a town called Splott, and that's where she experienced racism for the first time and was taken aback by it because it was actually the first time she was living in a white community. And race in connection, or the subject of race in connection with Shirley Bassey, is quite a complicated topic because of these early experiences and because of her heritage. One of the biographies that I've read of her actually says, or claims, that she considers herself to be white, which I have never heard her say in an interview. But there is some strange perception about her, about the relevance to the topic of race to her experience. And when I started digging into what she did, her first professional show was called Memories of Jolson, which was a tribute show to probably the most famous blackface performer in the history of American entertainment, Al Jolson. And so she was hired to be a featured singer in a show in which the star was white and appearing in blackface. A year up, so she was 16 at the time, I should say. A year after that, she appeared in a show called Hot from Harlem, so I think we can tell what was going on there. And on the next slide, we'll see some reviews of these shows using language of the day to refer to people of color. And what I'm interested in here is just to kind of talk about the fact that her early appearances were entirely framed by race, because we often hear in the discourse around her and around other popular performers that we shouldn't politicize them. But the whole point is that she started from there, that that was how she could get her career going. So let's take a look. You can see that all of these performances that she made were entirely about appearing alongside other performers of color. There were some mentions of her talent specifically. So she's described as attractive and an asset. It's quite typical of these early articles that she's objectified in that kind of way, and she's described as lively. She kind of clearly got fed up with this. By the time she was 18 and appeared in another show, there was this article I found from The Stage magazine where she says, or it's headed, "Shirley wants to be herself." There was also this article announcing her appearance at Piccadilly Club in Glasgow. And one of the things I notice is there's some confusion over her background. The one on the left says she's from the West Indies, and the one on the right says that she's American. There's criticism of her vocal technique. She's quite unreasonably being compared to much older, much more established performers like Ella Fitzgerald, who was at the peak of her fame at this point, and Lena Horne, who'd been a movie star for over a decade. And then there's this great quote from her. She says, "My style is my own. I am no copyist. I prefer to be myself." So I'm very impressed by how empowered she is, at least in spirit, because she's saying, you know, I'm not somebody else. I'm Shirley Bassey. Her agent at the time then joined forces with the leading theatre and TV producer of the day, Jack Hilton, and this led her to get the opportunity to appear on television. We find more reviews of her appearing this time at the Talk of the Town, which was one of the major places to perform in London at the time. And again, we see sort of the emergence of ability. The critic says she has something to offer, but has not yet fully developed her talents. And then this article on the right announcing her appearance in a Christmas show, again, basically focuses on her skin color. So this is not me politicizing the subject. This is just historical documents about what happened. A review of that Christmas show has the following bitter comment. "Shirley Bassey sings with voluptuous abandon," well, I can cope with that, "putting over with aplomb a new line in hoarsely slurred dentals and hissed sibilants, rather shattering if you like that sort of thing." So this 18-year-old woman had to deal with that kind of press. And then she's once more objectified in another review of this. This is this time in the international version of Variety, where she's described as shapely, with an emphatically sexy voice and personality. And then at the end of the article, it emphasizes her working class roots and talks about her having deserted an industrial job in Wales. How dare she? The following year, She appeared at the Café de Paris in London, which was a really, really major place to appear in the 1950s. This was where you would find people like Noel Coward and Marlene Dietrich. So for the young Shirley Bassey to appear there was a big deal. And suddenly, there's an intensity in the kinds of things they're saying about her. She's amongst the most striking new personalities. She still needs a little more experience, but should move safely into the top bracket. So now, suddenly, aged 18, or 19, sorry, we're seeing that she's going to be a major star. Skin colour is, again, one of the subjects of the article. Again, she's compared to much more established people. And then there's this horrible comment at the end that says her presentation can be faulted only on one minor score. Her choice of gown seems quite unsuitable for the occasion, which I find both offensive and kind of amusing, given that gowns are, well, one of the trademarks of the majority of Shirley Bassey's career. And I feel like it's ironic that this person made this comment about the thing that would become one of the biggest parts of her iconography. One of the things that her first agent did to help her become more distinctive was to commission material for her. And so he went to the person who he could afford, which was this guy who was famous for writing these two wartime songs, and asked him to write what I'm sure was supposed to be a masterpiece called Burn My Candle at Both Ends. And it was with this number that became a successful recording that she made her television debut at the age of 19. In 1956. And here's a little bit of it.
May not last, but it's all in the game, my friend. While it burns, what a fabulous flame. What an inhibition, we kill and he pretends. Wasn't it to turn the handle, open my door and spurn the scandal? Who wants to help me burn my candle?
Fun, but she didn't know what she was talking about or singing about. She said, I didn't even know what it was about in an interview. I'd never sung a risque song, and I think they purposefully didn't tell me so that I could give it that innocence. However, she was on her way to her career, and she recognized that one of the things she needed to do was to get her career going in America. Partly for just commercial reasons, that she needed to have an international market, she needed to be able to appear in multiple countries. And she talks in various interviews about her anxiety about this, because she'd read about Jim Crow laws and segregation, and she actually reported that her experiences there were okay. And she talks in this particular interview, after the quote that I've put on there, about how people thought she was Mexican, and that is why she was okay. But she describes seeing many incidents and problems for African Americans actually being badly treated, for example, being turned away from hotels. And so this made her very wary of appearing in America. Fast forward 3 years. And suddenly, a review of another show that she was appearing in is headed The New Shirley Bassey. And this time, there's a sense that something has changed, or she started to find the center of gravity of her performance style. So it says that the whole pretty dreadful show has been transported from the realms of mediocrity by the exciting presence of a new, much higher pressured, and yet more sophisticated and relaxed Shirley Bassey. And it talks about how she's now using her hands and her fingers in a more economical and measured way in order to communicate her songs, which I think remains one of the key qualities of her singing and her performances well into her life. It also talks about her being as much of an actress as a singer, sounding less American in her performances, and it ends, of course, with another comment about her hairstyle and the way that she looks, with this bizarre comment on the bottom left about how this new look is giving her a more feminine and more complicated womanliness rather than the unsubtle femme fatale we've been accustomed to seeing from her. So she's now 21, 22, and dealing with these sorts of comments. We can see it really was a difficult rise that she had through her career. Finding out exactly how she could go or what she should do was quite a complicated process. She herself was rather inspired by Judy Garland specifically. She says this in a lot of interviews. And I pulled out this little clip of Garland singing The Man That Got Away, because although I don't think Shirley Bassey sounds at all like this, I think there's something about the intensity and emotion of the performance that is something that probably Bassey drew upon. Let's listen.
Know what happened? It's all a crazy game.
This is what Bassey felt inspired by. She also loved Frank Sinatra. She described Sinatra as her idol. And then the three people to whom she was most commonly compared were Ella Fitzgerald, Lena Horne, and Eartha Kitt. So other artists of black heritage, and clearly that's the reason that they were being compared. I find her actually rather unlike all three of these vocally, but she kind of invited some comparison with Lena Horne because she frequently sang the song Stormy Weather in the first decade of her career, and this was Lena Horne's hit song. So here's a little bit of Lena Horne singing this.
Rain pouring down, blinding every hope I had. This pitter and patter and beating and spattering drives me mad.
So these are the sorts of things that she's being compared to. But still, even by into the 1960s, Bassey has not yet formed around a particular kind of repertoire and style. And one of the things that most surprised me while preparing this lecture was finding her recording of Ave Maria, in which she sings in head voice, i.e. rather like a classical singer. And it's a really impressive feat, the way that she goes from chest voice, which is how she normally sings, into this more operatic place, and then back again so smoothly. I really think that one probably wouldn't think this was Shirley Bassey singing if one just heard it on the radio. It's a real curiosity in her career, and it doesn't tend to appear on her greatest hits albums, but it's an interesting one, and it shows really how well she could sing. At some point between 1960 and 1964, something changed, and I just perceive that she became more comfortable with what she was doing and how she was doing it. And I would really love to attribute this to working with George Martin, the famous Beatles producer, on a song called I Who Have Nothing, which was recorded, I think, in 1963, where suddenly she sounds much more like an intense and lively Shirley Bassey. And after this point, it's like she's in a different stage of her career. And I feel that we can hear that something has changed when we compare her performances of the same song, As Long As He Needs Me, from the musical Oliver, in 1960 and 1964. The 1960 version is a studio recording, so it was made for listening to in the home. The 1964 version was recorded live at Carnegie Hall. I acknowledge that those performance circumstances are quite different, and so, of course, there's going to be some difference. But the second one is definitely quite a different kind of performer, it seems to me. So let's listen to a little clip of each. First of all, 1960.
As long as he needs me, I know where I must be. I'll cling on steadfastly. As long as he
really beautiful. But here's the 1964 version, and from the very start, it makes you want to sit up, I think.
As long as he needs me, I know where I must be. I'll cling on steadfast. As long as he needs me.
The This second one has a much more visceral, dramatic quality, it seems to me, and the vocal techniques that she's using are quite different. There's much more twangy the sound. She kind of sounds a bit American at times, which is interesting because she's in America at the time performing that. But I really think something has changed during these years. And then if we go beyond Goldfinger, which was 1964, remember, by 1 year into her next album, listen to the end of this track, The Lady is a Tramp, and listen to this final note where she suddenly sounds so liberated compared to those rather tentative early performances.
Yes, I'm a tramp and I love it, and I wish that you were coming my way, yeah. I wish that you were coming my way, yeah. I wish that you were coming my way. Yes, I'm a lady, but a tramp.
It was like she was unstoppable now, having been for some years kind of put in boxes resembling other people, if you like. That's how I think about it. And she says in this interview that in the very early days of recording, I had sung whatever was given to me. But deep down inside, I said to myself that if I ever made it, nobody would ever again tell me what to sing. So you can see that Diva is coming out, and it has this positive effect on the performances. Now, when I started preparing this lecture, I read the three obviously available published biographies of Shirley Bassey and found it a really difficult process because all three of them are commercial showbiz biographies. They're written to entertain, and each of them has some new information. But they are deliberately gossipy because that is the style of writing. And as I got more and more into them, I really struggled to determine what the facts were and what was just storytelling. And it became a real problem because I thought my instinct about her career is that as she becomes more and more personal or is able to project something more and more personal in her art, then she becomes more powerful and empowered by it. But then I was even struggling to find out the most basic details of her life because it's so under-evidenced. And one of the big problems with it is that all three of these books rely heavily on the autobiography of her first agent, a guy called Michael Sullivan, whose attitude to her and the way that he describes her in this book is just terrible, frankly. And there's no doubt that he helped to make her career and that he was the one that recognized her talent and provided the opportunities for her to become a solo artist, and helped her to get to America, and helped her to get to Australia, and really gave her lots of good advice. But the way that he writes about her, I find quite dehumanizing. And in the next couple of slides, I'm going to show you the kind of story that he tells in this book. So if you don't want to hear about her being hit by him and other people, then close your eyes and ears now, because it's quite horrible. So he says, and this is just one of many of these kinds of anecdotes in the book, I should say. So I'm not trying to sensationalize. I'm trying to show the basis for how her life is characterized. So he says, I'd arranged for Shirley to appear live on a Friday night TV show between her last show at the Adelphi and her cabaret stint at the Embassy. So he's talking about when she was appearing in a show in the evening and a cabaret later at night, and in between, he was taking poor Shirley Bassey to appear on the television, as if she didn't have enough to do. And he says, seconds after the show ended, she stormed in, flung part of her costume into the corner and burst into tears. She told me that she'd argued with the stage director over being in place on time. She called him names, he retaliated, and then slapped her face. The more I tried to calm her, the more hysterical she became. I reacted in the same way that the stage director had. I slapped her in the face. All the way to the TV date, she whimpered. But as we got to the Albany Club, where it was being broadcast, she started to shout, "You've conned me into this." I abandoned all gentlemanly behavior by pushing her, still yelling, into the ladies' lavatory and going in with her. It does get worse. Eddie Arnold, an impressionist on the show, heard the racket, and he too came into the ladies. "I know just how to deal with this," he said, after taking in the situation, and promptly gave Shirley a teeth-jarring crack on the jaw, her third slap of the evening. And What's even more jarring about this story is that I think he's either telling it to be amusing, or he's kind of trying to say it was so arduous trying to manage the young Shirley Bassey because we had to beat her up to manage her. I mean, it's that bad. And because these stories are repeated in the biographies that are available, it's really hard to see Shirley Bassey, how she felt, or what actually happened, because there's such a reliance on telling the same stories over and over, but then in the retelling, embellishing or changing. So I have struggled with this a bit. There are some facts, though, that are very public, and one of them is the fact that she had a vocal crisis in 1986 following the death of her daughter. In 1985, her daughter was found dead in the River Avon in September 1985, and Bassey lost her voice. Her voice gave out when she was performing in Australia, and so she went to a vocal coach at the age of 49, 50, and learned how to sing again for the first time. And she talks about it in this interview.
And I walk out on stage and the spotlight picks me up. And I got to the mic and I opened my mouth to sing Goldfinger and I went, it was terrifying. The rest of the tour was cancelled. I flew back to London. I went to my own throat specialist and I think he tried to make me feel better by saying, I have seen worse. I've seen yours, vocal cords worse. But I think he hadn't, and the next thing he said was, this might sound very strange to you, but because you've been in the business so long, and I would recommend a vocal coach. And I said, no, it doesn't sound strange at all. I'll try anything. Yeah. I was desperate at that moment. She put me through, you know, the vocals, and some days they were very difficult and little tantrums, you know, but she had such patience, and she nurse me through, and this was on and off for about a year.
A lot of pop singers do start to have vocal problems at this time of life, so the fact that hers came out of this trauma is kind of interesting, because in my view it's the thing that gave her another 30 years of career. Because if we look in 2018, for example, here she is with a tiny bit of the finale of the Bruce Forsyth tribute at the London Palladium. I mean, singing like this at the age of 81 is remarkable, I think.
It's almost like being in love.
I mean, look at her go. And therefore, she's just had so many more decades of work and had this distinguished second half of her career that she wouldn't have had she not retrained, bearing in mind that, as far as I can tell, she never had any kind of formal training. She was just self-taught when she was a child. So suddenly, she hits 50 and becomes like a student again, but also becomes more vocally efficient and reliable as a result of it, and clearly enjoyed it, because suddenly she's off again with many more tours, recordings, and all the rest of it. The other thing she's been willing to do a number of times during her career is to reinvent herself. And the first time she did this significantly was in an album called Something, which was released in 1970. And this was the first time when she really moved away from singing kind of great American songbook, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, Rodgers and Hart types of songs, or pastiches of those kinds of songs, and sang contemporary pop for the first time. So we get George Harrison, Michel Legrand, we get a song from the rock musical Hair, a very different Shirley Bassey, and instantly at the beginning of the title track, you can hear that suddenly she's singing pop music.
Something in the way he knows, and all I have to do is think of him. Something in the things he shows.
Good stuff. Sorry, we have to stop with that. And the key period of reinvention, which is the most curious really, is that between 1997 and 2007, which falls almost exactly between her 60th and 70th birthdays, when people might reasonably be, you know, not doing that much, and certainly not doing new things, she collaborated on several much more contemporary type projects or things that took her out of her comfort zone. Admittedly, she didn't vary what she was doing that much. She tended to bring the trappings of her performance style to them, but still, it's quite interesting she was willing to go out on a limb and do this. So the first one that comes to mind is this track, History Repeating, which was made by Propellerheads in 1997. And you can see in the music video immediately that there are these contrasts between old-fashioned traditional forms of recording and entertainment, things like there's an old BBC camera in there, and there's Shirley Bassey in her typical diva dress and all the rest of it, and then there's these two guys in the background doing their techno stuff.
What is about? There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
And this really did bring her to a new kind of audience. It did particularly well in the States. And I swear that I was sitting in Vienna on Sunday afternoon eating my Wiener Schnitzel, and it came on in the cafe. This was my attempt to get a break from Shirley Bassey from the weekend. Anyway, in 2000, after the success of this, Propellerheads and various other contemporary DJs and producers each took a track, a classic track of Bassey, and contributed to this remix album. So she started hitting the discos and being popular there. She didn't have to do very much, but I guess she gave permission for it. And again, there's some kind of looking towards a more contemporary direction. And then the big one was that in December 2006, she appeared memorably in the Marks and Spencer Christmas advert, singing her cover version of a Pink song called Get the Party Started. And in the M&S version in particular, the whole thing is a real pastiche of James Bond with the sort of Ice Palace, and there she appears at the end entertaining the crowd at the Ice Palace. Again, in her subsequent music video, which we'll take a tiny look at now, she is still wearing her kind of dress, but her her more voluminous wigs have been replaced with this spikier effort, and she's still belting away in there. There's a different style of music production in it as well. But you can see how she's just getting out there at the age of 70 now, a few months before she hit Glastonbury in the summer of that year, and again, achieving a new kind of audience.
I'm coming up, so you better get this party started.
It's cheeky, and her sense of humour, I think, has been part of Dame Shirley's longevity. The fact that she's humanised by allowing herself to be seen having fun rather than going, oh, you must take me very seriously as an artist, which she wants as well, but she's willing to giggle with the public. And her sense of humour has manifested in a number of ways. Of course, she started out in Variety, so she was used to working with comedians from the very beginning of her career, really. And she realised at some point that the best way to be a diva was to not act like a difficult diva. And she says in this interview, I used to make terrible scenes because I thought that was the way I had to act. Now I know better. I've learned to say sorry. But she didn't just say she was sorry. She took opportunities to work with famous comedians. And one of them was in 1979 when she invited Les Dawson a fellow working class performer, we should acknowledge, so they had more in common than we might assume, to appear on her TV special, and they have this little interaction.
I told you to stay in the truck.
Your fan club just arrived. They parked the tandem.
That's what I love about your show. You're laughing now, Shirley.
That's one more than you, pal.
I mean, music shows on the BBC didn't have to have these comic moments. She could have just performed her songs and done some kind of intervening chat, I guess. But she's deliberately gone after this kind of thing. And 10 years later, he rewarded her by inviting her onto his show, where she does a real self-parody of diva behaviour. Watch out for your China.
What better way than to rescue an ageing performer's career than by teaming him up with a megastar? I said, well, I'll try anything once. But I don't think even Rambo could save her career.
And of course, all this goes back to her iconic appearance in 1971 on the Morecambe and Wise Christmas show.
They asked me how I knew my true love was true.
All of this stuff has been really vital, and we might not think of it as an important part or a component of how to have a successful career in popular music, and especially not if you're a diva. If we think back to Barbara Streisand, like, this is not her bag. I mean, you can't really imagine her getting on very well with Morecambe and Wise because she would not be in control of what was going on, and they very much would be. And aging has been an interesting part of how she's managed her career. Something that really struck me, which I suppose I knew but hadn't noticed before, is how with various songs, she sang them for 40 or more years, usually in the same key and usually in the same or similar arrangements. And so singing the same song at the age of 30 and then the age of 70 is inviting comparison with your younger self, which is definitely a risky thing for any pop singer to do, or any singer of any genre to do. You know, people don't tend to sing Tosca for 50 years. And so I wanted to look at Big Spender and how she has taken this song, where it pretty much stays the same. She uses the same basic choreography, which I hadn't expected, but with some changes. And the words are the same, it's the same song. And yet she is making statements about aging that give her a sense of power. So we begin with 1971. No, yeah, 71. In this one, I think that she's just selling the song rather than making a statement about herself. See what you think.
The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender, good looking, so refined. I said, wouldn't you like to know what's going on? So let me get right to the point. I don't pop my cork for every man I see. Big, big spender. Big, big spender. Big, big spender. Spend a little time with...
If we move forward 25 years, so we've got the same song and kind of the same arrangement. And she's singing it again on tour. And now suddenly she starts abandoning parts of the song and showing how at the age of 59, she's fabulous. And so the song becomes much more about her, not literally, but it becomes a statement about her power, it seems to me. See what you think of this.
The minute you walked in the joint, I could... do you like that? I really big spin. Say, wouldn't you like to know what's going on in my mind? So let me get right to... Here it comes again.
I don't pop my cock for every man I see. Hey, big spender, girl, a little time with me.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that she's gaining power from her sexuality in a very conscious way, rather than it being just the consequence of singing the song in the older recording, where basically she's given this song and she's given this costume and kind of off you go and do your work. In this one, this is very much about her showing off. If we then go forward another 11 years, so she's a mere 70 years old, at Glastonbury in front of tens of thousands of people, and this time she uses aging and the song to make a joke about how fabulous she is. So she pretends to run out of breath and then shows that actually she's very much in control.
Yeah. A little time with me. Wouldn't you like to fun? How's it fun? Yes. Well, I could show you a good time. Let me show you a good time.
And then 2 years after that, at the trendy crowd at the Electric Proms, she's now 72, she gives a truly formidable performance that's all about how she generates her power through her sexuality and through her voice. And what's noticeable here is that she covers the stage a little less, and the performance is a bit more grounded, and yet it's this performance when she's older that seems to have the most impact of all, it seems to me.
And she walked in the joint. I could see you were a man of distinction, a great big spender, good looking, so refined. Say, wouldn't you like to know what's going on in my mind? You would? So let me get right to the point. I don't pop my cork for every man I see.
It's easy to get caught up in just how fabulous she is and forget that she's 72 and that it's remarkable to expose herself to doing that again all those decades on. And this to me is how she's helped herself to become an institution, but also this sense of moving towards more personal work, or the work being more autobiographical, is the final point that I wanted to look at. There are certain songs that she sings where she makes the audience believe that it's about her even when it isn't. Or she does things that make the performances particularly personal and that are particularly ouch to the audience. I don't think she particularly draws the audience in. I think it's an entirely pushed out to the audience kind of performer. And one example of this is the song I Am What I Am, which was a gay anthem written as part of a musical called La Cage aux Folles, which first appeared in 1983. She almost immediately decided to record it. It came out the following year. Her gay audience and gay following have been very important to her, and she's acknowledged them multiple times. And in this performance, actually, there's a line in the song about the closet. It's time to open up your closet, and she kind of half closes one of her eyes and looks directly into the camera. So there's a sense of something personal being communicated there. But the other thing is that the rest of the time she appears to be singing about herself in these songs, whether it's the feathers that she's wearing on her dress. And the very final shot when she looks into the camera is so searing. She sort of ignores the audience that's in the studio and looks into the camera at home, which really helps to reveal the sense of how powerful her performances are, but also how personal they are. Let's take a look.
And so, what if I love each feather and each spangle? Why not pray and see things from?
until you can say, hey, what I am, what I am. I am what I am, and what I am needs no excuses. I'll deal my own deck, sometimes the ace, sometimes the juicy.
I found this comment in an interview that seems to sum all of this up. She says, singing, even songs like mine, is a form of self-expression. Whatever some people may think, I'm acting a part when those burning and, to me, beautiful rhythms take possession of me. When I get out there under the lights and get wrapped up in that softly, fiercely seductive beat of music, something happens to me. The words come out with a throb and a quiver. A feeling springs from deep down inside my body and makes everything glow and burn. It's actually a magnificent description of the experience of music from a great performer. And it seems to me that the song that really, really most typically expresses this is a song that she often closed her concert set lists with, which is called This Is My Life. She first sang it in 1968, I think, at a music festival in Italy. Partly in Italian and partly in English, but it came from those kind of particular contexts and became kind of the song that epitomized her performance style. And we're going to end with this performance of it from 1996, when she was 59, from an audience with Shirley Bassey on ITV. And just three things to note on this topic of how personal her performances are. First of all, the arrangement is deliberately laid out so that there's a real build. Everything gets thicker, higher, louder, more intense. And that's very deliberately and cleverly engineered by the guy that did the arrangement. The second thing is the use of her eyes in this performance. Although I'm not claiming that she's Dame Maggie Smith or anyone Shakespearean, that there is something about the way that she acts this particular song, with her eyes looking down, looking up, looking side to side, looking at the audience, seems very calculated and interesting and seems to result in a certain effect on the audience. And the last thing is the use of her hands, which that critic first mentioned back in the 1950s, 1959, was it, when that reviewer said that she's finally learned how to use her hands in this economical way. So we're now, I can't count, 37 years on, and you can see that it's still working for her in this song, This Is My Life. So here we are.
I think I've got a mess I've made of my life. Crying over my mistake, forgetting all the breaks I've had in my life. I was put on earth to be a part of this great world as me, and my guess I just add up the score and count the things I'm grateful for in my life. Be
How's that for a final gesture? So in this kind of way, even though this song is not at all about her, and actually some of the things she's singing about aren't really about her life as far as one can tell, but through the way in which she performs, the way she delivers the words, and the things that we know about her life, she turns the personal into the public. And it's through doing this and becoming grander, maybe more even operatic in her work, that has allowed her in the second half of her career to become a kind of national institution. And in the last 12 months alone, she's become Companion of Honour and had a coin minted in her honour with her name and her figure on it, proving once again that divas are forever. Thank you.
Well done, wonderful. Thank you, Dominic, for another wonderful and quite moving lecture. My name's Milton Mermakides. I'm Professor of Music here at Gresham College, and it's my privilege to chair the Q&A now. I'll draw your attention to the QR code there. All you have to do is point your smartphones there and click the link. There are microphones in the room as well. We have questions already, so let's get to it. No rest for you. Has there been much change in her range over all these years? Has she lowered keys? It seems not, question mark.
The first time, I spent a lot of time looking at Goldfinger. As you may have gathered, I became a bit too fixated on that. And when she appeared at the Oscars in 2013 and sang Goldfinger at the Oscars, which was a big deal, she'd never appeared there before. I mean, she's not a movie person, despite recording those James Bond songs. She brought it down a tone. So, but she was, how old was she in 2013? I mean, 76, I think. So,
it's remarkable.
So there is some lowering, but I would have said that she did that to manage a nervous situation rather than her vocal range diminishing. The last time she appeared live that I'm aware of was about 2 or 3 years ago, at the age of 85, something like that, and she could still do a fairly credible job. I think you could hear the voice was beginning to go, but frankly, no, I think that it's still there for a long time. And that use of head voice in that early clip of Ave Maria is something that she refound with her vocal coach in the 80s. So they both talk, both the vocal coach and Bassey talk in interviews about her finding another octave of her voice, that's how they put it, which I find a bit incredulous, given that she made this whole track 40 years earlier or whatever, or 20 years earlier, singing like that. But I think basically her range stayed pretty much intact, and by learning how to sing healthily and with a bit more technique, it allowed her to just keep going and going.
Incredible.
And going. Yeah.
You've inadvertently answered another question here.
Sorry.
Does she ever perform nowadays? Did she officially retire?
No, I don't think so. She appeared in 2022, which was the 60th anniversary of Dr. No. There was a big concert at the Royal Albert Hall, which you can see on some, you know, streaming service or other. And she sang both Goldfinger and Diamonds Are Forever in that.
Well,
but
still
I'm not aware that she's sung since that, but...
There's an interesting question. When she talks about singing songs like mine, in mm-hmm. that quote, is she apologising for popular songs? Would she like to do opera or classical pieces, do you think?
I don't think she would like to do opera or classical pieces, but I think that she grew up in a time when variety was simply entertainment. I mean, there was no way that appearing at the talk of the town was seen as art. And I think she is basically an entertainer who's taken on this kind of gravitas so that we might now regard her as an artist. But I think that all she's doing there is sort of acknowledging that she comes from variety and that this is not... It doesn't have any kind of artistic leanings in that sense. I cannot believe that she would want to sing anything classical. Maybe she would. But.
I'm really taken with your analysis of the word diva and its mm-hmm. double-edged nature. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that there is no unique word for a male diva. Mm-hmm. They're just demanding.
Yep.
Or sometimes they're called divas, boring,
yeah.
that. Is that unique to the English language, do you know? Does diva mean diva in Italian in the same way?
Yeah. I believe it means diva in Italian, and I believe that il divo you know, is something that's used in connection with male opera singers in Italy, and that they would absolutely regard...
The same connotations.
Yeah, Pavarotti.
Okay.
Would be definitely a Devo. I mean, he apparently specified in his contracts how wide his red carpet had to be between his dressing room and the stage. So, you know, that is the negative.
I'd like to add that Dominic did not make those requests tonight.
How do you know? You've not seen my contract.
If there are questions in the room, you can just raise your hand. There's one over here. We'll wait for the mic to come over.
Hello there. Congratulations. Really fantastic. I was her musical director for 6 years, and mm-hmm. I just wanted to provide a little clarification
yes.
over the Oscars, which was down a minor third, not a semitone. Uh-huh. But it had actually been performed for several years prior to that in that key. But the one thing I just want to say, it wasn't that she was minimising risk.
Mm-hmm.
It was simply that that was where it sat best in her voice at that point. Mm-hmm. And I would say she is the least risk-averse performer. Because if you go back to that performance, you'll discover it's the only 100% live performance at the Oscars, whereas everything else you've seen actually had mimed elements to it. So I think the one thing that actually really typifies her is the fact that she accepts that risk musically, and what you see is that jeopardy and surviving and thriving because of the jeopardy.
And that's why it's exciting, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And you can tell it's live. And in other performances from the Electric Proms, some of the singing isn't so perfect and so great. And yet the whole thing is exciting in totality because you can tell she's actually doing it.
Yeah, really Absolutely. Great speech. Well done.
Thank you.
I have a question about Shirley, if I may call her that. If you give me permission. She has such autonomy and power, so it seems strange that she didn't want to correct this horrific biography of her, write her own, or somehow...
I don't know.
...address that.
Do you have any idea about her biography, her attitude to her biography? She seems, as far as I can tell, quite a private person, even though she's given a lot of interviews. The interviews tend to repeat the same sort of collection of stories. And although there are some personal anecdotes in there, I think she doesn't disclose that much in the interviews. She tends to just be promoting her latest work. So I don't know how she feels about those things. There are a number of horrific things. The third biography is particularly horrific. I mean, I won't go into what is alleged about her father, which may or may not be true, but it was covered in the Daily Mail, and there were all these claims made about her parentage. I never saw any reaction to it. I might be wrong. I mean, there's a limit to how much I can know about the totality of an 87-year-old who's still alive and working.
I'm trying to motivate Dominic to write her definitive biography. We'll get there. There's one question here. Mm-hmm. Does she define herself as a diva?
Yes. I think one of her tours is called something, has the word diva in it. It may even be Divas Are Forever. I think one of her DVDs is called Divas Are Forever, something like that. I mean, it's clearly something that she embraces as powerful. It's as if she's entirely in that lane, whereas Streisand is sort of, you know, I'm not difficult. Yeah. Take me seriously.
She owns it completely and sends it up in these contemporary performances.
Absolutely. Like, she just invites that label the whole time. And once she started doing that, that was it for the rest of her career, it seems to me.
Were those later collaborations of her own stipulation? Was she managed into them? Because they're very interesting and unexpected.
Well, I wasn't there. But the history repeating, there's some kind of documentary about this, and they claim that they approached her with it. So I believe that she didn't seek it out, but that she was up for it. The remix album, I think, came as a result of that. I don't know anything about how Get the Party Started came about, but she seemed, for the last 20 years of the main part of her career, to do something significant every few years. And so although she wasn't working the whole time, she would sort of make a decision to record a new album or do a particular concert or the Electric Proms or Glastonbury or something like that as a challenge. But she seemed to enjoy... in many interviews, she just talks about enjoying sitting watching the television all day. That seems to be a big part of Shirley Bassey's life, as far as I can see.
But it's a fascinating personality, and that quote about the experience of being on stage is
you
stunning.
You enjoyed that, didn't you?
Stunning, yes, absolutely stunning. Well, I think that brings us to a close, so one last round of applause, please, for Dominic and John McKeel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful.